Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 130, where Fritjof, Rohin, Anu, and Tom are discussing Thomas Kuhn's book on the philosophy of science, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, originally published in 1962 by the University of Chicago Press. In part two, we will debate to what extent Kuhn's concepts still hold in the present day. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So I just wanted to bring up this point that kept coming to mind while reading the book, and I kept putting aside because I thought somehow that it was not relevant or in a very Kuhnian fashion that maybe it was just an anomaly that I shouldn't pay attention to. But I wondered what all of you thought about the comparison between the structure of scientific revolutions and how one paradigm shifts to another, and you know how that compares with the idea of Hegelian dialectics. And what I've heard so far is the fact that, going by what Fritjof said, the fact that the idea of Hegelian dialectics itself is that the thesis and antithesis are not entirely discarded when the synthesis emerges. And so elements of those do show up in the synthesis. Maybe they're not entirely distinguishable, and that's been my understanding as well. And so in that sense, go back to what Rohin was saying, maybe if we talk about a complete destruction of paradigm, then dialectics is not the way to look at it, is what I've heard so far.
So maybe on Hegel, and I'm not like an expert on Hegel, I'm just in my master thesis, I was engaging with that a bit. But I think there's a specific term that he uses that has very nice double meaning that's maybe important in this context. That is the word Aufhebung. Auf meaning usually up, but in combination with Hebung, it can mean kind of like where like positive and negative, they come together and they cancel each other out. So on the one hand, Aufhebung is this kind of cancellation, but Aufhebung is also picking something up, making it, so to say, better, improving it, etc. And so this double meaning, I think, captures well what is meant with synthesis. So synthesis being both that you are reusing some of the existing, but also discarding some of it and creating something new out of that. And I think in that sense, so to say, the methods and the tools used in normal science being reused in, say, afterwards with the new paradigms, not so surprising, because as much as theory and paradigms are embedded into methods, you can still, like, you don't have to discard everything. Just like we, you know, you don't have to discard your hands just because you start moving from one instrument or another or one paradigm to another, but you're using them in a different way. So I think this double meaning of Aufhebung is nice to understand that it has this both meanings in there.
Now, I don't know if this aligns with Hegel. I'm accustomed to having, you know, like three different forms of synthesis. So there's one in which you would call a true, like a negotiation, where the two sides of the dialectic essentially come together to form the new paradigm going forward. That I think is that combination that we've been talking about, where a bit of this and a bit of that going forward until, you know, as the new paradigm, you're still reinvestigating the old questions. The second form is domination, which obviously the new paradigm wins outright. The old paradigm is essentially discredited outright. And that's the case that perhaps we immediately thought about reading Kuhn. And then there's the third case, which is stalemate, in which essentially both paradigms coexist for a period of time until that coexistence can't happen. I think there were a couple of cases of that in which we could just look at it as the times in which the new and old paradigms were in competition with each other until some tipping point occurred where the new paradigm actually did take over. So in essence, it created a synthesis of a stalemate that went on for a period of time, two different communities with two different worldviews doing their thing, until that was no longer tenable, and that created grounds for a breakage of that synthesis and a creation of a new synthesis, in which there was a new paradigm, a new unifying paradigm. Yeah, what we're kind of getting at is there's a whole broad range of outcomes that we can consider to be a synthesis. And I guess it kind of depends on how the new treats the old. Is the old ultimately deemed to be not useful, discredited, or is it something still yet to be preserved? And that may not be a scientific question, but it may be a political one because of the investments that each community has in their paradigm, that maybe an old paradigm would be held up because people still want to fund it, still think it is the solution to their ills, or are scared of what the new paradigm is going to do to their understanding. I hope that all makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that is a natural next step and more nuance to what perhaps Kuhn has done in this one, and of course, albeit impressive book, but a next step would be to think about those things, which is like, what are the kinds of paradigm shifts and, you know, domination versus not. I don't know the details of it, but I can kind of just refer the interested listener to go look it up. But Imre Lakatos, who was a philosopher of science after Kuhn, introduced the idea of the phrase research programs as a way to talk about, instead of paradigms, to talk about this kind of things continuing kind of in parallel. Sometimes one dominates, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the ideas flow between the two, depending on things like funding, etc. But he kind of reframed things as research programs rather than paradigms. Kuhn, some of the examples he uses does involve this nuance, even though if he doesn't explicitly call it out. But a lot of the examples he uses are also, and you know, a critic would say cherry-picked almost to show the domination view. So whether it's, you know, Einstein and Newton, or it's the idea of the phlogiston theory of air and gases, or he talks about electricity, and there was an effluvium theory where it's kind of particles versus charges that can act in a distance. So the kinds of examples he picks are the kind where it's very hard for both things to be true once the new paradigm comes into the picture. And it also reminded me of this a colorful sentence from a review of this book that came out, or a profile of Kuhn that came out in the 50th anniversary edition. It was an article in Scientific American, but the author said, "The proposer of a new paradigm stands on the shoulders of giants, to borrow Newton's phrase, and then bashes them over the head." So the Kuhnian view, according to this at least professor, is like you're standing on the shoulder of giants, but then also bashing them over the head. But the more Imre Lakatos kind of view is a bit more nuanced than that. One is, I think your point, Fritjof, was something Kuhn didn't actually articulate, but often even if theoretically you're bashing the giant over the head, you're still using a lot of the same methods or the same kind of ways of getting at truth, and there's still some perhaps cumulative growth happening on the method front. The other point, which comes out in the chapter on the nature and necessity of scientific revolutions, but again not explicitly called out, is that the ideas don't fully go away. So an example from the book is in the kind of medieval ages and antiquity as well, there was an idea of objects just having a certain nature. So a ball falls to the floor because it's in the nature of a heavy object to want to fall. And it would be called an occult quality. So in the Latin books, they would literally call it an occult quality, an occult literally just at the time meaning hidden and unobservable quality. And then the scientific revolution, Descartes, etc., the whole point was taking a more mechanical view, or what Kuhn repeatedly refers to as the corpuscular theory of physics, where no, you don't have these occult hidden things. It's, if a ball is falling, it must have something to do with the displacement of particles moving across each other and the ether and so on and so forth. And so for those people, that idea of a hidden thing would have been, let's say, dominated, to use our metaphor, bashed over the head, the medieval idea of occult qualities. But then 100 years later, or a couple of decades later, you have Newton coming up and talking about gravity as action at a distance, as an occult quality, basically a hidden property of attraction, repulsion. And so that idea was never fully gone. It came back just in a different guise. There are repeated examples of this through the history of science, which again suggests that nothing is really being dropped entirely or dominated, but perhaps brought into different paradigms at different points in time. Just a quick addendum on that idea of action at a distance. In fact, the medieval people liked it. The scientific revolution people didn't like it. I'm simply oversimplifying. Newton brought it back. Einstein didn't like it and took it away. And this Kuhn is explicit about that there was no action at a distance in Einstein's theories. And then now quantum physics and the recent Nobel Prize on quantum entanglement as well has brought back, and they call it spooky action at a distance in the case of quantum entanglement. So again, every 50, 60 years, scientists are saying this is unscientific or it is scientific based on just the ideas coming and going.
What I wonder then is, again, most of the examples were from the natural sciences. There is, you know, at least if one philosophically accepts this, there is sort of like a objective truth that the natural sciences are pursuing. So as paradigms shift, there's still something out there that's immutable that the scientists are not changing. They're just observing better. If we turn this around to the social sciences and start talking about paradigm shifts in the social sciences, to what extent does it differ from what Kuhn is arguing? Because one can argue, I suppose that would be my caveat, because I know that there's a wide range of philosophical views on this, but one could argue that studying humankind and its behaviors and attitudes and all of that stuff would lend itself to not having a fixed objective truth to the same extent, because what we observe, when we observe, we are influencing the very truth that we are seeking.
So, I mean, the social sciences is an interesting case, A, because it consists of multiple, let's say, subdisciplines. And so we think of economics as being a paradigmatic field, but where the paradigm is the rational actor model. And then you've seen, there you might see a bit of the patterns that Kuhn points out, where let's say you had anomalous results suggesting people behave potentially irrationally. You had behavioral economics slowly come up over the 70s, 80s, 90s, until Richard Thaler won his Nobel. When in fact, the articles that came out when he won his Nobel were about how he was an outcast from the field. Again, a very high status outcast here at the University of Chicago, but still. So econ perhaps provides some of those examples. I don't know if you've seen a paradigm shift. It's not like they've dropped the rational actor model. But then there are others, like perhaps management studies, sociology, etc., where I don't think of it. In fact, if anything, that idea of research programs makes more sense. So perhaps social networks research is a program rather than a paradigm, where people agree on a certain set of tools and how you study, how you collect roster data and what it means and how you can infer from structural links these other social components. But it doesn't seem like there is any paradigm. Again, setting aside Frithjof's point about method as paradigm, so like just the scientific method and or hypothesis testing, let's say, and inferential statistics, which seems to be a common paradigm across these sciences. But the interesting question then becomes, is it something specific about social science? Another interesting question is, have we just, you know, post this book was written in 1962, but in the last 60 years, has science as a whole just moved to a different, more complex, more nuanced, more fragmented place where you can't draw a picture of paradigms and communities and paradigm shifts? I'm not sure.
To that point, I was hoping to take a step back because this thought did occur while reading the book. In the book, of course, Kuhn talks differently about medicine and the social sciences than the natural sciences and the examples that he's talking about. I wondered about the nature of inquiry and the impact of those inquiries. So in examples like economics, for example, or medicine even, where the findings, the investigations, and what kind of import they have, they can be turned into prescriptions for behavior, very much so in medical science. But also when we keep repeating this statement that man is a rational actor, humans are rational, what it does to our own self-beliefs. So it feels like these were findings of the cumulative knowledge body of the effort that everybody's putting in have impact on daily behavior. How do we think about paradigm shifts over there? The idea that knowledge may not be perfect, that questions actually matter, what questions we ask, the impact of those questions, because that does not seem to be the concern here. In fact, towards the end of the book, Kuhn talks about the fact that there may not even be a truth. Why do we need to have a goal that we are working towards? issues like that. And so that kept coming to mind while reading the book. So I just wanted to take a step back from what Arun was saying.
That's fascinating, Anu, because it's true that the social field is different. There's a famous paper from the 90s in our field, I forget which journal, but it's called Bad for Practice by Ghoshal and Moran. And they talk about how even if we call a theory a positive theory, that we're just describing how things are, in the social world, it still has a normative effect where people are like, oh, this is how things are. People are self-interested. Then I should also be self-interested. There's the concept of, again, also identified, you know, by Robert Merton and others, of self-fulfilling prophecies in the social world. And so it is fascinating where, on the one hand, let's say, to Kuhn's point in the natural sciences, a paradigm doesn't really affect the physical phenomenon. It affects your interpretation. You're looking at the same thing, but it might affect what you see. But in the social world, it's even more complex because it can actually affect the phenomenon. Your paradigm can then lead to a self-fulfilling prophecy where people start behaving according to that paradigm. And then maybe shifts are even harder, would be the kind of taking this logic a few steps forward. But it is fascinating to bring in that idea of, in the social world, the phenomenon itself is endogenous to your theorizing. And so there's a self-fulfilling prophecy based on what your paradigm is.
I also think there's a much more natural tendency to the stalemate version of synthesis. And I'm going to bring up another book that probably a lot of folks have read as part of their socialization process into academia. And that's it's called Designing Research for Publication, and it's by Anne Huff. The reason why I'm bringing that book up is because of the way that she characterizes how scientific communities compartmentalize in the social sciences. And she uses the cocktail party as the metaphor. And maybe this is the closer example of the programs that you're talking about, Rowan, where when you go into a cocktail party and you're trying to join a group, you've got to speak their language. You kind of have to go into that conversation already kind of knowing the language a little bit and understanding what their worldview is. And of course, you have all of these different groups in the cocktail party that are somewhat separate and distinct from one another. And if you are conversant in one group, you're not conversant in another. That's why I'm thinking that, this sounds a lot like the stalemate type of synthesis, where you have potentially a lot of these groups that are all looking at exactly the same thing, coming up with their own lines of inquiry, their own constructs. And yet, if you step back and listen to the cocktail party, somehow all these conversations at once, you realize that in some cases they are talking about exactly the same thing. But because of the way in which they approach it, there's differences. Enough of a difference that you really can't force two groups to come together. And then the other article, another article that may be popular, I don't remember the full name, but it starts with "That's interesting!" exclamation point. And that's an example to me of what reinforces some of this differentiation, the separation into groups, because in order to convince a group that your research project is worth it, you have to meet the qualifications of what make it an interesting research project in that group. It's very reinforcing, because what's considered interesting is, by the way that it was described by the author, and I forget who it is, it is based on what keeps that group together in a paradigm of normal science. It has to fit within the conversation that exists. So, yeah, go ahead.
I think you mean Murray Davis? 1971, that's interesting, towards the phenomenology of sociology and the sociology of phenomenology.
Yeah, and one thing that, and this maybe suggests that in Kuhn's terms, social sciences are pre-paradigmatic, is that we do need to think about this explicitly. And in our papers, we make it explicit based on which, our introduction sections of our papers tend to announce who is the groups of scholars we're talking to, who are we citing. And as writers of papers, we think about who do we want as an editor, who are the... So we're not going based on just the phenomenon. Let's say I study innovation, and so this journal, it's more like, okay, am I citing qualitative scholars of innovation? Am I studying citing process views? The fact that we have to so explicitly think about all of this means there's less of a single dominant paradigm where you can just take it for granted that the only way I know how to do research is the way that any editor at AMJ or ASQ would appreciate. which is not true in our field. Different editors will have different taste functions and so on, which suggests a pre-paradigmatic field.
Couldn't one? I have no idea if there's any work on this already, but can't you also say that it's simply a post-paradigmatic perspective, where it's not that a field is dominated by one paradigm, and that we are open enough within fields to allow for different paradigms to happen, unless we are, I don't know, into economics or whatever. It's just simply from my own work, looking at the work of Simon and the people that were kind of like following the footsteps of Simon. That's where I feel like there's a very clear a paradigm there that still dominates in specific fields and subfields, the relevant questions, the relevant methods, the relevant theories. And if you're not playing that game, you're just, irrelevant to them. Because it makes it sound so negative that it's pre-paradigmatic. And I feel it's maybe something beyond this paradigmatic perspective. Because I also wonder how much that actually holds for the natural sciences, like how much agreement is there between biologists, chemists, and physicists?
So I do know that in physics and in cosmology, they do have standard models. And so now when you have these particle accelerators or the new telescopes come with new findings, all the reporting is about like, oh, is the standard model, does it hold? So the fact that they have that phrase shows you, and which is why, of course, Kuhn was studying natural sciences where you can have it. And again, for example, he didn't have many examples from biology. So maybe it's a censored data set that he's drawing on as well, where there happen to be those. But I do know in those fields, there are still literally explicitly called standard model. But yeah, to your point about like management studies or just social sciences, it does sound more like you were saying, Tom, like research programs with their own kind of rules for advancement and what works, what doesn't work. Also, what questions we're interested in. So the behavioral theory people are interested in decision making, ultimately decision premises and structures and cognition, attention, etc. So perhaps it transcends the whole concept of paradigm and moves instead to the Imre Lakatos type concept of research programs. And then for all we know, of course, we're going off of this one book from the 60s, but for all we know, philosophers of science have also now moved to this kind of a view rather than a more simplistic paradigmatic view.
I've been to AOM this year for the first time. Before I've been to design conferences, to IRAM, EGOS, Pros Philos. And I realized, you know, a lot of the conferences I went to, they were, you know, you were in a kind of community already that uses similar theories, similar thinking. And even if someone uses, say, a different process philosopher than I do, I can still recognize, oh, this is process philosophy. I get it. Okay, there are some distinctions, but that resonates. But with AOM, you know, you go into a room and there's a topic that you like, but they're using different words, different concepts, different methods. And like you ask a question that like in a process audience would be like, oh yeah, of course, yeah, you're studying emergence. Like how else would you do that than process? And it doesn't resonate at all. So I found that really interesting to see at AOM when you mingle between different communities, how you're getting so completely lost in translation that it feels like it almost becomes meaningless to have this conversation, because the tools, the concepts, the glasses, the theories that you're using are so different that it's difficult to really have that kind of conversation.
I wanted to bring up the fact that, so if you come into the management studies field, right, and social sciences broadly, but management overall throughout the book, I kept trying to compare, you know, where we are with respect to what Kuhn is saying and some of what Rohan was saying. So I think there is a semblance of a paradigm, to go back to what Fritjof was saying. I think we do agree. I mean, all of us, I think, do agree on what management studies aim to do, or at least what we talk about generally, improving management of things in organizations, etc. Like very broadly, that humans are rational actors, these foundations on which we've built the field, so to speak. I think importantly, what we consider as alternate lines of thought. So the fact that the 3P model of people, planet, profits, or the shareholder, priority, or topics like diversity and inclusion are still considered peripheral. They're alternate and they need to be ceded space too. That to me is a sign that there is a bit of a paradigm, shared beliefs, values, assumptions that we work with. At the same time, there are other, I thought, indicators that make me question that idea. The fact that today, as Rowan was mentioning, you know, when we talk to journals, we try and kind of, you know, generate new research. The fact that we're looking for a puzzle, whereas Kuhn does talk about the fact that you're not looking for new puzzles. Your puzzles are decided in a paradigm. But the question we almost always ask is, yes, what's interesting? What's the puzzle here? What is the novelty in this new piece of research? We don't test, we don't replicate, you know. So I think some of those things point to the fact that maybe then we have not achieved a paradigm, or we're trying not to become a paradigm. So I'm not clear at what stage we are. Is it pre-paradigmatic or post-paradigmatic? And importantly, I think in our field, the context matters. And so can we even achieve a paradigm? Can we achieve models, as Bruin was saying, you know, standardized general models that apply everywhere? In fact, I would go to the extent of saying towards the later part of the book, where he talks about the fact that, you know, Western science, or, you know, science emerges in... Yes, sorry, Tom, go ahead.
Yeah, this is where professionalism literature, I think, illuminates well, because now with natural sciences, who's doing the science? Are the scientists. Who's taking action with it? It's the engineers. Two very, very different disciplines that have very little to do with each other. Another difference with the social sciences, and I think Abbott's examples that we've covered in this program kind of bear out, is that the line between the science and the practice is a little bit blurred, or they overlap significantly greater. I'm probably not going to use the best example. Y'all can tell me that it's a bad example, but think about the organizational consultants who've written a lot of big books about change, organizational change, not only describing through their studies of organizations what change looks like and what's good or bad, but also prescribing the, you know, in essence, playing that engineer role, prescribing the outcome. And I think that there's a bit of a different expectation from society about they'll understand or appreciate the distinction between science and engineering on the natural science side. But then when it comes to dealing with problems of a organizational slash people side of things, I think there is more of an expectation of utility that comes from what's being studied. When social scientists are doing things that don't readily translate to a prescription, they may look at it and say, that's a waste of time. Or maybe more likely to say that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And there's also a question of like level of abstraction, where at a high level of abstraction, there probably is a paradigm. There's this book called Power, Pleasure, and Profit by a historian called David Wooten. And he talks about, back to your earlier point, Anu, he does an intellectual history of kind of social thought, let's say, John Locke and others at the time, the utilitarians, Jeremy Bentham, etc., and talks about how over time it was kind of made a thing that humans pursue power, pleasure, and profit, and kind of behavior almost came to meet that over the centuries. Whereas in Christian thought, there was more of a mixture. There was also thought about virtue, etc. So at that level of abstraction, you will see commonalities where, whether you're in psychology, sociology, management studies, econ, it's altruism or pro-social behavior that's the puzzle to be explained, not rent-seeking or utilitarian behavior. Value capture is not a motive you have to explain, but if there's alternate models, those become the puzzle. So at that level, there is probably a paradigm at play. Our early org theory texts are, you know, why do people organize? The fact that that is the question, and that you have to answer it in terms of cost benefit, transaction cost, communication cost, etc. Versus obviously people would just want to hang out with each other. Why would they ever maintain market arm's length relations? That could be a flipped question if the paradigm itself was flipped. So at that level, yes, there is a paradigm. The fact that we, again, to summarize what I just said, the fact that we have to explain altruism, pro-sociality, or why people want to organize and work together rather than maintain market contractual relations tells you that there's a paradigm at play.
Yeah, that does make sense. Going back to something I said earlier, based on what you were saying, I mean, when I was referring to puzzles, now I'm wondering, and again, what Kuhn says in the book, that maybe is it the same understanding of puzzles as what he says versus what we talk about today when we say, where is the puzzle in what we're doing? But that thought just came to mind in terms of our conceptualization of the puzzle itself.
I also wonder in the social sciences, does the meaning of anomaly change? In the natural sciences, you can imagine that, you know, okay, there's an anomaly built into the paradigm that is something that just needs to be uncovered. But is the anomaly in the social science side more crafted, perceptual? I mean, to get to the point of, you know, why do we see so much diffusion and change in the social sciences? Is it partly because we're looking for anomalies differently than perhaps the natural scientists are?
There was, I don't know the details anymore, but there was a study, I think, by Italian physicists, where according to their calculations, something had moved at quicker than the speed of light. And they were like, you know, that's not possible. We can't explain it, but we still publish it so that others might try to explain it. And I wonder if we have studies where someone basically publishes, so there's this weird thing. I can't explain it, but I'm pretty sure it's pretty important. Can someone else explain? But again, I think that would bring us back to the point of that research is not a one-man sport. And it's not a one-paper sport. And it's seldomly just one paper that kind of like moves the needle, really. Yeah, giving maybe a bit more freedom to find these anomalies. And even if we can't explain them, to still talk about them. Instead of having the finished paper and the finished thought and everything explained and everything fits neatly together.
Yeah, the tricky thing from a, I guess, Kuhnian lens is that, and having an anomaly presupposes having a paradigm. And so to the extent that we are either pre or post paradigmatic, it's more like one man's anomaly is another woman's obvious finding or something like that. And so it's harder to immediately be like, to have a convergent view, even that this is an anomaly. Let's now debate it. Kuhn also uses a great example, similar. I think I read the one about the Italian physicists that you're referring to as well, Fritjof, in the news. Kuhn talks about the discovery of Neptune and how the kind of theories at the time suggested that there shouldn't be another planet there. And then when it was floated, I think it was Sir William Herschel who discovered it, when it was just floated to the community, in fact, they saved the paradigm because the community said, for this to be true, given our theories, then it can't be just Neptune. There has to be another planet. And so if anything, they then predicted, or was it Uranus and Neptune? I think it was the other direction, but they predicted Neptune based on that, based on Uranus as the anomaly, to save the paradigm. And so I think, yeah, when Kuhn talks about how it can progress the paradigm or change the paradigm, but one thing that's a common assumption across all is that everyone agrees that X is an anomaly, and then that is trickier. It might be fine within a community. So let's say people who study brokerage and social networks might all agree on what an anomaly is, but then someone else who studies community organizing might come and say, no, it's obvious to me that a dense network is better than having structural holes or something like that. So that's the tricky thing in our field, I think, consensus on what is anomalous. Yeah.
I do agree with Rohan there. I'm looking back at the definition of anomaly here, you know, a phenomenon for which the paradigm has not readied the investigator. So given that we've been talking about this broadly received paradigm that we're in and then built on the foundations, for example, of, say, economics. So more is better, humans are rational, etc. Now, if we think of this idea that more is better and hence then growth is better when you talk about organizations, companies, firms, I think anomalies in our field, as Rohan was saying, are essentially just different ways of operating that may not have been accounted for. And Tom, to your point, I do think that then they are crafted and created because there are things we've told ourselves. There are ways we're shaping ourselves and coming generations, you know, beliefs about ourselves. So now we believe that more is better or that we are rational and we are self-interested, etc. But then we see behavior in cultures where, for example, circular growth exists, that it's not the idea of unlimited, you know, like absolute growth, which has no bounds, but the idea that, you know, growth happens in a more moderated fashion in tandem with the environment and the resources it provides. And then the fact that that has to be accounted for because we somehow believe that this paradigm cannot be disturbed. But in that culture, as you were saying, Rohan, it's another person's way of being, so to speak. So I wonder if there are anomalies at all, or do we just want to believe that there are anomalies in our field?
Yeah, I like that. I like that thought, because that would also kind of explain why you see any time that you have like a major shock to the social system, the pandemic, the emergence of AI, any of those big things that are just sort of happening, it's almost like gravity. It just sucks a whole bunch of people into it. Let's just all go study this and look for something that's anomalous, whether it's reinforcing of the existing paradigm or it is something that tries to illuminate something interesting just on the virtue of the interestingness of the context. So we oversaturate. I should pose that as a question. Do we oversaturate? Did we actually get so much out of everything that we studied from the pandemic that we thought we should have? Or did we just succeed in reinforcing what we already knew? Did we really find that the pandemic introduced something that exposes some anomalies that informed a different way of looking at the world? Or did it just simply entrench us in the communities that we're in? I do not pretend to have an answer to that. I just know that it became such a hot topic that everybody was looking at it, and now it's AI.
I think sentences that I found very striking in the book, where there's a sentence which says, you know, a paradigm anomaly occurs when nature has somehow violated, you know, what we understand about it, sort of, or the fact that you need to beat nature into the boxes that you've created. And I kept thinking about those. I mean, nature is out there, it's operating, and it's, in a way, people are out there, you know, society is out there. Of course, there is this recursive iterative relationship, but the fact that we probably need to account for things in a way that we don't in nature. And that, I think, is the thought that keeps coming to mind. Do we need to beat our understanding of people and people into those boxes? Or how do we go about doing the social sciences, so to speak?
Yeah, so what you're saying is social science is a competitive sport. We're coming up on time. Do we have any last thoughts?
How could one apply Kuhn to organization studies in 2025? So I was a bit thinking, I don't know how to say that in English, but there's this children's story of the emperor and his new clothes, and the children, they're pointing out, oh, wait, he's funny, he's naked. And so maybe an issue is that the children, they have to go through so many years of schooling that tell them about all the fancy new ways that emperors have new clothes, that by the time that they are taken a bit more serious when they're doing their PhD, they're not there anymore asking, hey, funny, he's naked. I wonder if we take an organizational lens on scientific revolutions and take the current state of academia, what do you think? So something that concerns me, for example, is that almost all top universities require publications and top journals. And almost all top journals are staffed by people from top universities. So it's really difficult to do something very new if kind of like the people that are benefiting from the old are also the ones that are basically saying, yeah, no, totally, yeah, you're right. Those are not close. They're not there. I'm curious what your thoughts are on this.
I'll take a first stab. I think the paradigm shift or the anomaly that we're wrestling with right now is whether science itself is the right paradigm. You know, when Kuhn wrote this book, science was seen as very much a positive. Science as a whole was seen very much as a positive. There were a lot of benefits, material benefits that were coming from it. There was high prestige. I'm not so sure that's the case now. I think that we've seen plenty of instances where there's not just a repudiation of science in some quarters because the benefits are not as apparent anymore, but the cases of fraud and poor scholarship, questions about AI, sorry for bringing that one up, that are raising questions about the value of science. And so, in essence, science is facing its own anomalies. And what is the alternative? Well, the alternative to a scientist is rather disturbing. But to some in society, it's actually potentially a good thing, because science itself has run into problems, or I should say the academic community has run into problems. So in some ways, I think that this, you know, I did mention the word competition before. The competition of ideas is actually, overall, I think, is a good thing, because every community is subject to these kinds of faults if we're not careful. And having the competition of ideas, whether it's scientific versus non-scientific or within scientific communities, is healthy to keep everybody honest. You know, in that sense, revolutions are necessary, but what we have to do is ensure that we shape the revolutions so that it becomes, so that the trajectory that it goes on is a beneficial one, as opposed to potentially being non-beneficial. Again, drawing back from Abbott's examples of professions that went south.
It's interesting, Tom, that I had a very similar thought while reading the book and now when you're saying it. When Hoon writes about science and the enterprise of science, and there's so much sort of promise in it, I kept thinking of this more recent piece by Roger Friedland about how science has now become almost religion-like, that has become dogmatic. Hoon himself talks about the role of values and ideology towards the end of the book. And so when that comes in, science as ideology, and that kept coming to mind, I think science, as you said, is under attack primarily because of those reasons. It was supposed to be an open endeavor. Newer ideas were supposed to find place, and paradigm shifts would happen, you know, one community, one small group at a time until the last holdouts were converted or gone. And that's not the science we find ourselves within today. So when organization studies, management studies is trying to be a science, I think we are also plagued by some of the same problems. And a note that I'd made was, for example, you know, laboratories and where we do research. The fact that we've talked about research programs, the fact that we're trying to extend someone's research program, how much scope does that leave to desettle any arrangements, as Joff is talking about? Because the interest is very much to maintain the existing relations. When Kuhn talks about knowledge mediated relation between the scientist and, you know, the phenomenon. So I think we are being plagued by the same problems, and we do need to reconsider that and be more open to sort of ideas that will help us shift our understandings given grand challenges. The other thought was the description of science that Kuhn gives does not leave a lot of scope to tackle grand challenges. That is left to the social sciences. The fact that, you know, there are these open problems with not very clear solutions. You know, there is this line about who is likely to do to come up with more solutions faster, as if that is the parameter we should go by, versus impact versus importance.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're like zooming out now even further to almost science as a paradigm. And let's say, you know, religion is another paradigm, and church and state and different paradigms in human thought that might come and go, and the same analysis might be relevant. And it reminded me of how in fact, in one of the chapters, I think it was either 7 or 8, Kuhn explicitly draws an analogy between political revolutions and scientific revolutions. And he says it involves first a degree of polarization, similar to the state of crisis in the case of a given scientific field. And second is so much that people no longer agree on the same evaluation standards, the same frameworks. And so typically the revolution then happens through other means, not through the same forum of debate. So let's say in the case of political, it might be you're no longer going to the UN, you're just using force as a means of deciding it rather than the same set of debate criteria. And so in the case of social science or science, similarly, if it's that extreme, the way Kuhn draws it out with the political metaphor, the revolution would come from outside, probably universities, because it would involve a different set of criteria altogether. It won't happen on the terms of us saying that, oh, we should expand journal list or something like that. That's not the way it would work in the Kuhnian sense.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.